Our view of immigration historically can be a romantic one. Many of our ancestors did come into the country through New York Harbor, passing the Statue of Liberty and dreaming of a better life ahead of them. Many of them achieved that better life, but not without some grumbling from the people who were here already. Our guest this hour writes of the debate that led to the United States eventually turning the flow of foreign immigration into a trickle nearly a century ago. It was a long debate, and Daniel Okrant's book is a big one. It is called The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Daniel Okrant has been writing and editing books and articles for a long time. His career stops include being the first public editor of the New York Times and an editor at large at Time, Inc. Daniel also gets credit for inventing Rotisserie League Baseball. Daniel Okrant, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
So there was a startling factoid on the second page, and that is you talking about the role that your publisher for this book took in the eugenics campaigns.
I'm so glad you brought that up. A few other people have. Yeah, my book is published by Scribner, which is the really the same imprint as the famous Charles Scribner's Sons, the publishers of Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Thomas Wolfe and Edith Wharton. And long after, not long after, but a while into doing the research of this book, I learned that Scribner, in fact, had published almost all the books that promoted both the junk science of eugenics and connected it to the anti-immigration movement of the period. And most shocking to me, the editor of many of these books was the almost sainted Maxwell Perkins, probably the best-known book editor in the country's history.
Wow. So some weight and some heft went behind the eugenics campaign when it was at its peak.
Absolutely. And when I brought this to the attention of my publisher, it's not the family doesn't own it any longer. It's now corporately owned, like most things in the world. They were a little bit nervous, saying, "This is kind of embarrassing about our past." And then they came to the realization: better that they should publish it than somebody else.
I can see the point there, yeah. This is bound to be a deflating book for people of conscience, but you write that it is not the story of the interplay between xenophobia and immigration policy. How often have we been down this road?
Well, it goes back to the 1750s when a prominent newspaper editor, whose name happened to be Benjamin Franklin, published articles in which he attacked the German immigrants coming into Pennsylvania at the time, saying they were corrupting American life and the English language. It's a pattern in American history. It swings back and forth. At one moment, we are the welcoming open gates, asking the huddled masses who yearn to breathe free, as the poem goes, to come to our shores, and then the next minute, putting up a keep out sign, and then it's alternating every 20 years, 30 years or so. And right now, the keep out sign seems to be hanging up there.
Well, let's talk about the what you call the junk science of eugenics and how prominent and otherwise respected some of the people were who embraced it. There were some big names in here, aren't there?
Yeah, eugenics begins really as an offshoot of Darwinism. Not that Charles Darwin himself was particularly an advocate of it, but if you begin with the notion that we are not all the descendants of Adam and Eve, which was the pre-Darwinian notion of creation, then you begin to realize that if we're not all related to each other, some of us are better than others, that we have a different genetic makeup. Long before the word gene or the word genetic was were conceived, a cousin of Darwin's named Francis Galton launched the eugenics movement, which in the UK. His idea being, if we found the best and married them to the best, then we will have the best possible children. Over time, that idea got distorted, and by the time it came across the Atlantic to the U.S., it had morphed into, can we keep the least among us, the lesser people, the inferiors, as the term was used, from reproducing? And in 1916, a man named Madison Grant published a book by Scribner, my publisher, that tied together the xenophobia of the time with this eugenics idea and created what was called racial eugenics. But the people who supported it, there were aspects of it supported by leading American institutions, Stanford, Harvard, Princeton, the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, the American Museum of Natural History, people like Theodore Roosevelt, Margaret Sanger at times supported eugenics. It was a very large umbrella that hovered over the lives and actions of many, many public figures.
And while the science itself, or the junk science, was eventually discredited as it needed to be, it had an effect on the debate and way we do things. You begin with the Immigration Act of 1924. Were the gates more or less open to Europe until that passed?
Until 1921. There was a temporary law put into effect in 1921 that closed them for a time. But up to that point, there was no limit on immigration of white people or black people, interestingly, because of the Nationality Act of 1870. But the Chinese had been barred totally in 1882, the Chinese Restriction Act. The Japanese, by a winking agreement between the American and Japanese governments in 1907, immigrants from the Indian subcontinent were coming in throughout much of this period, but then they had the right of citizenship denied them by the Supreme Court in a unanimous decision in 1922.
Wow. You read about some of the things the Supreme Court did in quite a few years, actually, through our history. It just boggles the mind. So the quotas in the 1924 Act, you point out, were based not on the 1920 census, not on the 1910 census, not on the 1900 census. Why did they go all the way back to 1890?
Because that's before the big immigration came from Eastern Europe. Now, all the groups that I talked about before that have been excluded by law, none of those were white people. But then there was this idea forming in the 1890s and the early 1900s that the Eastern and Southern Europeans weren't white people or weren't like white people. One of the leaders of this movement was a man named Edward Ross, a very prominent sociologist, president of the American Sociological Association, a left-wing political figure, a progressive, a socialist. He was later the national chairman of the American Civil Liberties Union. And he describes Slavs, people from the Slavic country, that they will do work and live under conditions that would kill a white man, making this distinction between this notion of white being strictly those people who came from Northern and Western Europe, as opposed to the mobs coming from Southern and Eastern Europe. That immigration begins around 1890, and that's why they went back to that date to set the quotas.
Which they did in 1924 with that Immigration Act. We'll talk about that act and what led up to it in further detail with Daniel Okrent, the author of The Guarded Gate, when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Daniel Okrent is our guest. He is the author of a book called The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America when this prevailing opinion grew up that said that people from Eastern and Southern Europe weren't as good as the people from Northern and Western Europe, and so ultimately led to the Immigration Act of 1924. You can join our conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've touched briefly on Francis Galton, who was largely behind the wandering off the science trail and off into eugenics. And you mentioned that he was a cousin of Charles Darwin. Did Darwin himself give any real comfort or encouragement to Galton?
Well, when he read Galton's book, in which Galton first put out the principles of eugenics, he responded very positively. He said his mind had been opened so much that he had to stop reading because he thought it would upset his constitution in some way. He was so excited. But over time, he did not stay with it. I think that the notions that Galton first put forward of planned breeding to improve the species appealed to the sense of evolution that Darwin, of course, understood better than anybody at the time. But then he came to realize that it was something that suggested a form of government control and government intervention into private lives that he could not countenance.
This brings in the science of Gregor Mendel, too, who had been dead for a while by the time this became a thing, didn't it?
Mendel did his famous work with the pea plants in that Moravian monastery in the 1860s, but he was an unknown figure. His papers were not published in anything that any scientists were reading at the time. They disappeared. In fact, someone found a book in Darwin's library after his death that did make reference to Mendel's research, but the pages of that book had not yet even been cut open. The book had not been read by anybody. It was not until 1900 when there was a sort of simultaneous discovery, both by American and European scientists, of what Mendel had discovered. And of course, this played right into the hands of the eugenicists, because they were able to, using Mendel's basic ideas and distorting them terribly, they thought that they could turn breeding into a precise science as if humans were pea plants.
You mentioned the lab on Long Island. There actually was a federal eugenics lab that lasted for decades, didn't it, at Cold Spring Harbor?
Not entirely federal. I mean, there was some federal support for it. It was supported by the Carnegie Institution of Washington, largely originally by the fortune made by E.H. Harriman, the railroad baron. But it was incredibly prominent, as it is today, although they've cleaned up their act quite a bit, prominent research installation for primary research, or doing the basic research that others could apply to manufacturing and to breeding, as it turned out.
You've already mentioned the periodic eruptions we have of anti-immigrant sentiment, and you provide quite an image in the book when you describe it as attitudes towards immigrants formed a perfect sine wave. So if you think of the S-curve, it's like, you know, hey, we feel good about immigrants. No, we don't. We feel good. No, we don't. And what do you find to be the period of that generally?
Usually there's some other strain on the nation's self-image or the nation's comfort at the time. It can be a market crash or a terrible economic depression. It can be war. It can be the aftermath of war. It could be, and I think it has a lot to do with it in the present moment, the fear of terror. There's another factor that suddenly makes some people say, we have to keep these people out of the country. And what was specific about it back in the 1910s and 1920s was this notion of genetic inferiority. Madison Grant, whom I mentioned before, the way he put it in his book was really rather interesting. He argued, based on almost nothing, that it is well known that if you match any two races, that the offspring will eventually revert to the lower race. Therefore, the Nordics, who are the best of the Europeans, if you match a Nordic with an Alpine, not so good, then the result would be an Alpine. And if you matched an Alpine with a woeful Mediterranean, the so-called bottom of the three races, the result would be a Mediterranean. And then he said, if you matched anybody from any of the three European groups to a Jew, the result would be a Jew. And it was this notion that biology, this determinative nature of biology, made people who were they were, without any reference at all to environment, carried the day.
So where did he get the idea that there were lower and bottom races, that you could compare groups of people and come up with some sort of formula indicating which was higher, which was lower?
I think this is the classic case of beginning with a prejudice and then finding the science to support it, or the asserted science to support it. Men like Madison Grant, who was very, very wealthy, and interestingly, he was the leading conservationist in the country. He saved the redwoods of California. He founded the Bronx Zoo. He was chairman of the American Museum of Natural History. He wanted to protect the American landscape and, as it turned out, what he considered the American bloodstream. He was this man about New York who was horrified by what he was seeing in New York as the population of immigrant Jews and Poles and Russians and Italians and others began to fill Manhattan. And he felt they were inferior. Why were they inferior? He was living in Park Avenue in a beautiful apartment, and they're living in slums. So what is the intellectual argument we can use to carry this idea of inferiority forward? And that was where they grabbed on to eugenics. And what the result was, what had been, the people had been trying to stop immigration in Congress since 1895, when the first limitation law was, affecting Europeans was passed but vetoed by four consecutive presidents as it came up. They had been trying to get this enacted into law, but it was very bad politically. You didn't want to go out and say Jews are inferior or Italians are inferior. You couldn't say it in public. But once you had science saying it, that was a different matter. These were inferior people. And in 1921, Calvin Coolidge writes an article right before he's sworn in as vice president that says that now that we know that biological laws, that's the term he used, biological laws have determined these people are inferior, we have to have legislation to keep them out.
Oh, boy. We're talking about The Guarded Gate, Daniel Okrent's book about immigration and our efforts to shut it off from Europe. It's subtitled Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. So an immigration restriction league, the IRL, pops up in the mid-1890s. Who were some of the people behind that?
They were followers of Henry Cabot Lodge, the first Henry Cabot Lodge, who was a senator from Massachusetts for 36 years and one of the most important and powerful figures in the history of the U.S. Senate. He was the one who authored the first restriction law that was passed in 1895. He came from a world, a very self-enclosed, self-contained world of upper-income descendants of the Mayflower and the other early exiles from the UK, the so-called Boston Brahmins, and that's where the Restriction League was formed. The most interesting guy in the Restriction League to me is a man named Joseph Lee, who was known as the first citizen of Boston. He was himself a progressive. He called himself at times a socialist. He supported any number of good works, any number of different kinds of good works. He paid to keep the schools of Boston open at night so immigrants could learn English. That was one of his beneficences. But privately, those same people he was trying to teach English to, he wanted to keep them out of the country. And once he wrote to one friend and said, "All Europe might soon be drained of Jews, to its benefit, no doubt, but not to ours." And that was his justification for devoting an enormous portion of his fortune over a 30-year period to passing anti-immigrant laws. He also said he had the fear that the U.S. would become, quote, a Dago nation, close quote. And therefore, I believe, he said, in exclusion by race.
I never cease to be amazed by the names and the motives and the justifications here. Henry Cabot Lodge even sought out a poem to counter Emma Lazarus's poem that we talked about earlier.
Right. There was a poem by another Boston, a well-bred Bostonian named Thomas Bailey Aldrich that he called Unguarded Gates. I was able to adapt that for my title. And it is just as stirring as the great Lazarus poem is. It's a terrifying sort of definition of what needs to be done, that if we leave the gates unguarded, our country will be ruined. Oh, liberty, white goddess, stop this from happening.
Well, that's a long way from, send me your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse.
Exactly.
I lift my lamp beside the golden door. So we get The Guarded Gate instead, which is the title of Daniel Okrent's book, subtitled Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. You can join our conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. A lot to talk about here. We're open to you by phone at 800-838-3760. You can send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. There was a close call, I noticed, in 1897. You mentioned some laws vetoed here. Grover Cleveland vetoed the literacy test bill on the last day in office, which would have been the people needed to know the Constitution in their language?
Right. This was a very direct way, although a little bit obscured in its language, of keeping out the people of Eastern and Southern Europe, because it required literacy, and those were countries in the 1890s, where education was very sparse and an enormous number of the immigrants who were coming in were indeed illiterate. And when Lodge rises in Congress, in the Senate, to make his case, he lists the countries that these people, most of the people from these countries, aren't good enough to come here.
Sorry, I'm getting a flashback to S-hole countries all of a sudden.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Except in this case, the S-hole countries were such things as Greece, Italy, Poland, became the Czech Republic. It was really I'm not suggesting that, well, these are better countries than the ones that Mr. Trump referred to, but it was a very different kind of prejudice that was in play at the time.
So we haven't talked about the resistance here. I mean, what forces were amassed politically in favor of the immigration status quo?
Well, there were the obvious political forces were the elected officials from districts that had large foreign-born populations. The large numbers that continued to come in from 1890 until the first restriction law in 1917 and the first quota law in 1921, those millions and millions of people were becoming citizens and they had votes. But you will see, if you read the congressional record of the debates, the people who were making the case against these restriction laws had last names like Callahan and Feingold and Buzinski and any number of other ethnic names. They were representing ethnic neighborhoods. And the inevitable way to dismiss their complaints was to point to their ethnicity. The greatest intellectual opponent of the eugenicists and of anti-immigrationists was the great anthropologist Franz Boas, who remains today the most important figure in the history of American anthropology. And from the very beginning, he attacked the eugenic idea, the idea that people can be sorted by nationality, by ethnic group, and assigned a level of intelligence. And he fought it assiduously. But his opponents said, well, of course, he's a Jew, and easily dismissed it.
How did the assassination of President McKinley in 1901 get anti-immigration forces fired up again?
Well, it didn't help that the man who killed McKinley was named Leon Czolgosz, C-Z-O-L-G-O-S-Z, as the bad joke would say, like an eye chart. Proponents of restrictions said, see, if we let these people into the country, what will happen? They ignored the fact that Czolgosz was born in Alpena, Michigan, and his family had been in the country for over 50 years at that point. But it was the sort of thing that could be used to wave the bloody flag that says, see what's happening if we don't do something about this.
So then we have McKinley's successor, Theodore Roosevelt, and his family. They had some clear thoughts on who were good people and who were not. And it sounds like his wife might have been a little more extreme than T.R. was.
Yeah, she was really something. She said about the servants, you know, if they had our brains, they could have our position, but they don't. She wouldn't let their children play with children who were not of our world. Teddy was more of a populist than that. He had to be. He was in the political arena. But he also carried forward this doctrine of fear of what he called race suicide, and that in which he was making the case that the immigrants coming in, particularly from the Catholic countries of Eastern Europe, were having so many children that they would soon outnumber the pure Americans. And interestingly, at the time, they called themselves Native Americans. The pure Americans, the Native Americans of the period, would be outnumbered by these Europeans. Therefore, it was unpatriotic for a family not to reproduce, to have at least four or five children.
So the people who called themselves Native Americans, was it just restricted to what? The British Empire and the Netherlands and France or something?
Right. I mean, it was really those who had been here for a long time and looked like their neighbors. I'm sure that there were many who came in the late 17th century and early 18th century who probably weren't as purely, as pure as, say, the Mayflower descendants. But yes, these are we've used many terms for them, some not so friendly. These are the WASPs. This is the Episcopi. This is the Brahmin, the Boston Brahmins, who proved so important in the early years of the Republic.
The term race suicide that you mentioned was getting used certainly around T.R., if not by T.R. himself. The term race itself, how long had it been used in the United States by then?
It starts around the time of Darwin. I mean, there are references, obviously, about the distinction between the white race and the black race and the yellow race, but the division into many, 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 many races, that comes post-Darwin. That's in the 1880s, 1890s. There are some scholars who identify 30 different races, some 12 different races, 40 different subgroups. But race then, by 1890, 1900, it really meant what we would today call ethnicity. The Russians were a different race from the Italians, who were a different race from the Norwegians, and so on and so forth.
You know, this idea that you can breed and get better humans, a la Gregor Mendel and his peas, you know, we're talking the junk science of eugenics here. We talked about some of the adherents here, but even W.E.B. Du Bois weighed in on it?
Yeah, Du Bois was one of several leading African-American figures who wanted to promote the breeding of the best among them. He talked about the talented tenth. That was a phrase that Du Bois used a lot. The very best of the then, as it was called, Negro race must be the ones to lead and must be the ones to reproduce in large enough numbers so that we have a large enough leadership.
So here again, this seems like something that gets said in America, and I don't know if it gets said in the rest of the world as well, but I live in America. But, I mean, you get to the point where you get people saying things like, well, it's only the dumb people who have babies. What are we going to do here?
It's a little scary. The social science evidence is pretty clear that that environment is at least as important, if not more important, that nurture is as important or more important than nature. But you cannot separate the two. The human being is not made of one or the other, and that's what these racial eugenicists were arguing. The first opposition based on eugenic principles was not to races who were immigrating or ethnic groups. It was to individuals. Charles Davenport, the leading American scientist who promoted eugenics, he said, he wanted to keep out what he considered inferior, the blind, the deaf, epileptic, feeble-minded and such, not races.
So, but it gets extended from there, obviously, over time, and then we get to the situation that we're talking about here in the book, The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Daniel Okrent is author, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Daniel Okrent, writer and editor of many books and articles for a very long career, including the first public editor of the New York Times. He's written a book about immigration a century ago and what we thought about it then, which led up to the largely shutting down of foreign immigration in 1924. His book is called The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. You can join our conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I was thinking during the break about Charles Davenport and his wanting to eliminate basically genetic defects, but there's a difference between trying to breed them out and trying to find cures and remedies for them. And so did he himself, did Charles Davenport begin to guide things into taking it beyond just trying to get rid of defects and getting into eliminating entire classes of people?
He, as I said, he began looking at individuals in not a very nice way. He did believe in eugenic sterilization. He did have staff members who were responsible for the sterilization laws that spread across the country in the teens, 20s, and 30s, by which 70,000 Americans were sterilized involuntarily because of perceived defects. These were people who lived in prisons, mental institutions. They were wards of the state, so the state made these determinations. But after Madison Grant picked up this idea and expanded it to races in his book, The Passing of the Great Race, then Davenport kind of found himself in the anti-immigration camp ever more increasingly. And he says, interestingly, in 1920, in a letter to Grant, he says, can we build a wall high enough to keep out these inferior races?
Wow.
Well, they could, and they did.
Well, you point out that the money from the Harriman family, this is the railroading Harrimans, the Southern Pacific and Union Pacific Railroads, they did a lot to support Davenport's work, it sounds like.
She, Mrs. Harriman, Avril Harriman's mother, the widow of E.H. Harriman, the wealthiest woman in America, she supported the first 10 years single-handedly of the research that that Davenport and his colleagues conducted to acquire the so-called evidence to make their argument. She said that she wanted to help improve the quality of American people.
How strange were the bedfellows on both sides of the debate?
Well, imagine, if you will, that you have somebody like Ross, I mentioned before, you know, the chairman of the ACLU, and Lee, the leading liberal progressive in Boston. And then on the other side, you have people who are very openly proud to call themselves racists, arch conservatives in many ways, like Madison Grant. It was marriages of, this was another form of breeding, I suppose. It was a political marriage of convenience. They didn't care much for each other in other ways. Well, an even better example would be Samuel Gompers. The labor movement didn't like immigration. Labor never particularly likes immigration. They think it brings wages down, which in some cases it does. But here was Samuel Gompers, the head of the AFL-CIO, making common cause with Henry Cabot Lodge, the aristocratic Brahmin, who disagreed with him on everything else. And Gompers, in fact, wrote in his memoir the oddity of being on the same side as Henry Cabot Lodge. But the detestation of immigrants kind of made the oddity even.
Let's get some phone calls in here. Here's a call from Phil in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Okrant, the author of The Guarded Gate.
Oh, yes, thank you. I'm enjoying the show. Did the immigration policy of the government contract and expand according to the needs of the industry within the United States?
Well, before the passage, it's a good question, that before the passage of these acts in 1917, 1921, 1924, industry was against any restriction on immigration. In fact, industry argued very strongly against the 1882 Chinese Restriction Act, specifically because of the effect it had on wages. Jim Hill, the railroad baron, said, "Why would I want to hire an American when I can get six Chinese to work for me for the same amount of money that one American would require?" So industry was on the side of restriction until in the 1920s, when the economy is going really, really well, and when the black migration from the South is coming to the industrial cities of the North, and they see another source of cheap labor, then they turn against immigration too.
So I was going to ask you, you point out how optimistic the early days of the American century were, and that the, you know, for a while, the Immigration Restriction League had no victories to point to. What we talked about the assassination of McKinley playing a part in this, but what else changed the tide?
Well, I think that this idea of science, this idea that if it's coming from the institutions it was coming from Harvard and Princeton and the Museum of Natural History and the Smithsonian to a degree and Cold Spring Harbor, it's kind of imposing. At the same time, it told a certain part of the population that you are better than these people. And that's something that will always get somebody's attention. So there began in the early 1910s, and Davenport was involved in this, the better baby competitions at state fairs where people would bring in their children to be judged by eugenicists, and on the basis of God knows what, they would pick the best ones. By the 1920s, they were picking fitter families, the best families in America. And strangely, all these people, or almost all of them, if you look at the pictures, they're blonde, and they're very clearly from Northern Europe, and they're tall, and they have various features that would distinguish them from the huddled masses that were coming to Ellis Island.
It really got into stuff like craniometry, too, as you point out in the book, where you're measuring skulls or shapes and things like that would dictate, you know, how smart you were or what race you came from.
And they would find a way to determine that certain large heads were smart and certain large heads were not. I mean, it was just crazy. It was nothing resembling real science. But it's easy for people to be dazzled by something if it flatters them, and that's what was going on.
Another call from Joe in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Joe, go ahead.
Thank you very much for your book. It's a much needed it's a subject on which we need more and more.
Joe, speak right into the microphone, please. Right into the sound hole on your phone. You there? Okay. It just came in muddy. That's why I was asking that question. But
yep.
I guess he was going to ask if you have heard about the book Exterminate All the Brutes by Sven Lindqvist.
Yes. I am familiar with that book. That was one that I consulted in the early days of my research. And it too, was an expression of the the notion that eugenics should drive our breeding decisions.
So what was the research like for you personally as you read page after page after page and all these
books?
It was
not fun living with these guys for almost 5 years. It was very discouraging to particularly to read the words of people I had admired, but that the whole nation or a large portion of the nation got caught up in this was bad news. But then, by the time I got to the end, I saw the light, which is the country that we have become. And in fact, the high wasp Brahmins who promoted the immigration restriction, in a way, from their perspective, they were right. Everything they feared came true in time. In other words, they don't run the country anymore. Their kids don't get into Harvard automatically anymore. Many of their descendants are married to Italians and Jews and blacks and Chinese, and they are not in the position of dominance that they feared they would lose with more immigration. The immigration laws didn't change until 1965, but for the past 50 years, well, until this current presidency, it's been rather open to people from everywhere, and that's what they didn't want.
You just said immigration law didn't change until 1965, so have we eased the immigration law from 1924 a bit over time?
Oh, 1965 is the first meaningful easing is in 1943 when we have made a wartime alliance with Chiang Kai-shek's Chinese, and suddenly Chinese are our allies and we can bring them into the country. The Chinese are also fighting war against the Japanese. And we didn't want to bring into the country, and as we all know, we locked up in our form of detention camps or concentration camps. But not until 1965 in the Johnson administration, the Great Society, did the 1924 law get revoked. The quotas remained in place. One particularly awful moment occurred in 1939 when a bill was introduced in Congress to allow the entry of 20,000 German Jewish children outside of the quota. And it lost. It was defeated in Congress. And one person, her name was Laura Hodeling, she was actually Franklin Roosevelt's first cousin, she said the problem is that 20,000 charming children would grow up to be 20,000 ugly adults if we let them in.
Yeah, between this and we had an interview on a while back too about the Carrie Buck story, where you got members of the Supreme Court talking about we've had enough imbeciles, and just some of the ways in which we viewed intelligence and put people on different levels as different animals almost just shocks to this day.
It is, and that Buck v. Bell decision that you mentioned, authorizing sterilization, among the people who voted for it, to allow it, were great heroes of American freedom and liberty. Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis D. Brandeis. It was an 8-1 vote. Interestingly, the one vote against sterilization was cast by a very, very conservative justice named Pierce Butler, who happened to be a Roman Catholic. And though he wrote no opinion, I think it's reasonable to think that he voted voted against the idea of sterilization, of forced sterilization, because of Catholic views on birth control.
You mentioned already that the ways in which we had eugenics leaking into the popular culture and having things like the baby judging contest at state fairs. There are illustrations in the book, including a poster from a Kansas fair in 1926, arguing that we should breed people as carefully as pigs. And it's really interesting because there it's like a specific recipe for tainted kids. If you have this person and this person, you're going to get these kinds of kids. I mean, where did that come from?
From really bad research conducted by really unqualified people. Davenport and various other people who ran these research institutes would hire recent college graduates or students during their summer breaks, give them 3 weeks of training, then send them into various parts of the country, particularly in the Northeast, where they would interview people and find out their genetic background by determining whether is this person ugly, is this person tall, is this person smart, stupid, what was his grandfather like? And the neighbor would say, oh, his grandfather was an alcoholic. Oh, that proves something else. When all of this data of nearly a million people being analyzed in this way was given in the late 40s to the University of Minnesota, which had a genetic research institute, the director of the institute said it was all worthless.
Is the lab still open in Cold Spring Harbor? Is that
Yes, it is a very distinguished place that has produced 8 Nobel Prize winners. It doesn't do anything remotely related to eugenics. It is one of the leading research labs in primary research in the country, and does get a lot of government support. And they're doing things in microbiology and oncology and astronomy and a variety of the sciences, but nothing resembling this.
Well, we don't use the term eugenics anymore, but the kind of thinking behind eugenics is never completely out of the zeitgeist, is it? Especially when you think about TR talking about race suicide and the people now talk about, was it white genocide is the term?
That's right. There seems to be this need for people to find somebody who is lesser than they are and to want to keep them away or to get rid of them. It's some peculiar and obtuse form of the human makeup. I am only elevated if I can find somebody who is below me.
Now, you'd mentioned you think this is largely about terror. There's a certain level of, like, they're taking Americans' jobs away feeling abroad in the land right now. But you honestly think this is primarily a post-9/11 reaction?
Well, yes, I think it's largely a post-9/11 reaction. The taking away of American jobs is an interesting one, and I can't claim to be an expert on immigration today, but this is a country that is operating at full employment, 3.8% unemployment, the lowest it's been in nearly 60 years. It doesn't seem to me that Americans are losing jobs that they can fill. We might be losing jobs to immigrants at the very lowest end of the economic scale, because American citizens don't want to do those jobs.
As has been pointed out many times, and there's a really interesting vignette in the beginning of the book about Ellis Island, how different it was in 1925, a year after the Immigration Act of 1924 passed, which is what this book is about. The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept 2 Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Daniel Okrent, the author, our guest. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Jeffrey.